listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Professor Grant Schofield, welcome back to RCR. Great to talk to you again. The last time we talked, you were falling out of love with your university. Have you fallen back in love with it?
No, I think it's I think things are moving a little bit politically in this country and more in the right direction, and thanks to some probably more of the minor parties than the major ones. And so I think the sort of freedom of speech thing's moving along. Although, Peter, I should say that I've been told specifically that appearing on Reality Check Radio could be career limiting, especially talking to Peter Williams. And so, but nonetheless, undeterred, here I am.
So who is this dreadful person that thinks I'm a dreadful person and that could put your career under threat?
Well, it's the university broadly thinks that if you appear at least to be from the right, I have no idea where you actually are from, then you shouldn't be allowed to have, they should censor those conversations, which is an odd thing to say. And I think that probably speaks a lot to where things are still at. There's a progressive left element within universities that's still driving sort of managerial overreach, and that's still an issue. But you know, I suppose I'm at the stage of my career. Well, if they decide to do that, well then, I'll go that way. But I doubt that's going to happen.
I think when we talked last year, Grant, you were either on a 4-day work schedule anyway, or you were thinking of going to a part-time schedule. What's your current status and current employment status at AUT?
Yeah, I'm a 4-day status, but I'm thinking of going to a 2.5 or a 2 or something. Just have to discuss when I might get to that. Yeah,
he's back, other
fish to fry. Plenty of other good work to do.
So, is it because you're getting frustrated with academic work, or is it because you think you can do better work in the community in other fields of endeavour, particularly in research?
I think. Well, for me, I think once you look above a certain level of professor at the university, then you probably start to think, well, that'd be a bit of a narcissistic cesspit. I'm probably not going to survive in there very well. And not saying there's good people there as well. So I think that's not somewhere most people want to go who are interested in making a difference in the world. And then, I've been frustrated with my research over the years of lack of ability to make a difference on the ground. So, you know, the more speaking, the more you know, programs we can start, the more health coaches we can train, the better, so far as I'm concerned. So that's what probably floats my boat these days. But notwithstanding, there should be, Peter, in academia, you know, like we've got a bad reputation, but frankly, academics have done quite a lot for the world over the centuries. You know, we came up with science, we split the atom. I use the royal we here, but the discoveries in medicine have been profound, and those have been done in a context of free and open debate, criticism of the scientists, and those sorts of things. It's even in public policy, the critic and conscious of society role that academics have had is actually a valuable one, and people get annoyed with us, like sort of being on the taxpayer's back and nose in the trough and all that sort of stuff. And there is an element of that. But I still think that academics could actually play a useful role in society if we were to do what we're supposed to do.
Indeed. Well, let's talk then about this paper, which has been written by James Kerstead, formerly of Victoria University, although I suspect he might have lost his job there for being an academic freedom advocate. You've written the foreword to this in-depth paper. It's called Unpopular Opinions, Academic Freedom in New Zealand. Now, my speed reading of this paper suggests that we have a real issue about academic freedom in this country, which actually could be bordering on the illegal if you consider what the Education and Training Act of 2020 says. So let's put a broad brush on it before we talk about some specifics in the paper. Why did you write the foreword, and how desperate do you think the situation is?
Well, I wrote the foreword because I also wrote the foreword for another piece of research that was conducted last year by the Free Speech Union, and I roundly received a bunch of emails, mainly from the University of Otago, you know, shut up, you shouldn't be saying anything, this is crappy research, you know, low response rate, you know, and just all the things that go on in research. And I don't think they didn't have a point, but, you know, this actually goes another whole step, because it's not just that research, but there's a, I suppose, research coming up from both all over the world and other sources in New Zealand, as well as some detailed discussions of some fairly high-profile cases. For example, the Listener 5. James goes into excruciating detail about exactly documenting what happened, when and why, and what was done. And if it's clear from this body of work, and I think it's an important one, that there's three things happening. One, I haven't actually got much comment because I know nothing about it. One's about the Chinese Communist Party. Well, yeah, okay. The second is the creeping left progressivism, and that's a thing. That's critical race theory, critical gender theory, COVID saved the world. You're not to have an opinion that's counter to ours, and we could be offended, so don't even say it. So that's an issue. And then the second issue is just this creeping managerialism, where the brand of the university is more important than the law, and there is a sort of great part of the law and the Tertiary Education Act, the Education Act, where there's this academic freedom of speech. But it's actually a fair bit of responsibility, because you've got to understand what your lane is, you've got to speak coherently within it, and you've got to be prepared to debate things. But it is actually part of your job, and I don't think most academics have understood that. And I fear for the younger academics that what they do is toe the line because they want to get promoted. Now, I don't care if I get promoted, because I can't get promoted. And if they sack me, so be it. But at least I'll go out doing the right thing. So, that's probably, it's mainly the younger academics that I get worried about. They don't say much because they're scared. And that's not a great work environment.
Okay, let's talk about a couple of these headlines that are mentioned in Dr. Kerstead's paper. Radical progressivism within the universities and the managerialism in the neoliberal university. It seems to me that in a certain recent case at your own university, at AUT, those two headlines had a major confluence with a woman by the name of Kylie Quince. There she was, absolutely abusing an attitude of an eminent KC, Gary Judd, and at the same time, I would have thought, giving AUT a very, very bad name by telling this eminent KC to, what was it, stop being a dinosaur and go and die in the corner. Now, that must have raised quite a few eyebrows, I would have thought, amongst the administration, the managerial class of AUT. Was any action ever taken against Ms. Quince that you heard of in the
faculty room? I'm a bit out of the loop on that one. Although, when you're up for free speech, I suppose you're up for it, in for a penny, in for a pound, either way. Oh, totally,
I can't deny what she's trying to say. She's entitled to her opinion, but this business about not giving the university a bad name. Well, I'm sorry, with one phrase, go die in the corner, that has put AUT's law school in particular way, way down in my estimation. Don't know about yours.
Yeah, well, that's the way it goes. but right. So nothing's been said about that one, which is interesting. But better not talk to Peter Williams, because that might be dangerous.
Yeah, that's right. All right, the radical progressivism within the universities. Let's look at that particular headline. You've just given us the issues, which appear to be absolutely no-go zones, unless you have the approved narrative. And what are we talking about here? Treaty of Waitangi, transgenderism.
Believe it or not, you can't use the word Treaty of Waitangi in the university. It's not a word.
Is it Tetiriti, is it?
Yeah.
All right. I suppose within the Faculty of Public Health, is it an issue that you have to deal with anyway? I mean, aren't you supposed to treat your patients and teach your courses under the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, whatever they might be?
Yeah, apparently. No one really checks up on you, though, so that's one good thing about the university.
Grant, you're being just a little bit loose around the edges here. Are you serious about that? Do they not have, audits of the content you're teaching in your courses?
Yeah, but, the sort of nepotistic of the system, you'll just send, for quality control, you'll send your course material to someone else at another university who's generally a friend of yours. That's sort of... this is the whole problem with peer review as it exists. People who like you do it if you get something for someone you don't like, you send it to someone who doesn't like them. And, you know, the whole system's a bit of a rort, to be honest. It was designed in the best possible way, but in reality.
So what are we going to do about it then? How can we get credibility back into university teaching if that's the sort of thing that's going on, not just with the attitude that you might have towards your particular subject, but to people like Professor Quince, who seems to have a particular way of teaching law students?
Well, I think the reality is that what we don't see now is free and open debate, and that hurts. You know, people are partially harmed by that. Let's face it. You know, I have been, and it's just part of the job, right? You're like, I'm trying to change the dietary guidelines. I'm battling with the guys that invented them. You know, it's not going to be pretty. They take it personally. I'm concerned about it. We're just going at it hammer and tongs, and you know, it's just every debating technique, you know, and you're throwing stuff at them and they're throwing stuff at you. That's how science has really worked. And I think, unfortunately, that I'm going to offend someone, or someone might be someone I know, not me, but someone I know who I can't name might be offended by what you're going to say, is probably the major issue within all of this. So if everyone just got a bit braver, and bravery doesn't mean you know, you're a hero. Bravery means you should carry on even if you're a bit scared. You know, I often carry on going, oh, gosh, I don't know the consequences of this. I'm a bit worried about it. I probably shouldn't have said that. But if it's the right thing to say, I'll try and say the right thing. May not always get it right. And so, but then people go, well, Grant, that's easy for you to say because, you know, you don't care anymore. It's not that I don't care. I actually care deeply. That's why I'm doing it.
Of course. You're an academic. You're a public health professional. You've devoted your career to it. Of course you care about the nation's health. Yeah. What you're trying to do, as I've discovered in previous conversations with you, is to get the population to look at health from a real health perspective as opposed to a medical perspective. In other words, let's look at lifestyle. Let's look at the food we eat, the exercise we take, as opposed to getting a whole load of prescriptions. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, and I've been thinking so much about that in the context of mental health recently, Peter, and I think, you know, having just spent so much time working around all the data and thinking about the biology of all this, I think, you know, it's so interesting. One thing that we ignore in mental health is, you know, this is sort of dovetails onto the discussion we're having about hurting people's feelings. It's like, oh, now you're feeling a bit bad. Don't talk about it. Avoid feeling bad. You know, when it could turn out, especially for our young people, part of the problem is that we are avoiding any of this stuff. We're avoiding the rough and tumble of play. You know, we're sitting on devices, we're not going outside, we're not engaging in sport. Bull rush was cancelled, you know, in our generation. And you know, the net result of a lack of doing anything that makes you robust means you're no longer robust. And you can imagine how well that goes down in public health, especially mental health circles. But, you know, there's something in that discussion.
Of course there is. We'll come back to that in a moment. Firstly, yeah, let's talk about this business of hurt feelings, hurty feelings. you know, AUT has been an absolute shocker in terms of shutting down events, hasn't it, particularly around the transgender issue, because it apparently makes some students feel unsafe. I mean, this is in itself is just a bizarre word, that people can feel harmed by speech. I mean, that is one of the laws of the land and the Bill of Rights, or is it the Human Rights Act, which says you have a right to be offended, and you must take offence, and sorry, cupcake, you got to suck it up. I know it doesn't say that in the legislation, but that's the overall impact of it, isn't it?
Yeah, and just to be clear, I'm a real supporter of the law for two reasons, and one is in that there are things that go too far and, you know, harm people. That's why we, you know, mostly, you know, just don't carry around guns on your person, because, you know, someone will get angry and shoot you and that'll be bad. And so, you know, so we don't do that. That's probably a bad example. But you know, numerous things where there's a legal framework going, that's a step too far. We've all decided as a community we probably shouldn't do that. So we'll stop that. So that's the law. And it shouldn't be ambiguous. And it's not ambiguous. And when it is, it gets tested. So that's the law. Unfortunately, we've gone to a thing that isn't the law and gone another step further. Goes, well, it's completely within the law, but actually I'll decide what's important to be said and what's not. And you just can't have that in a functioning society. It doesn't end well. It logically doesn't end well. It's just a silly idea. If it's really bad and it's hurting a lot of people and people are doing it willy-nilly, then change the law. If not, carry on.
I remember when I was doing talkback radio four or five years ago, and the mental health epidemic, for want of another word, just seemed to emerge relatively quickly. And I remember putting out to an audience, which admittedly were the majority of whom might have been over the age of 50. I said, where the hell did this mental health epidemic come from? When I was growing up in the 1960s and 70s, people didn't have mental health conditions. We didn't have allergies to peanuts either, for that matter. But all of a sudden, we seem to have a whole lot of different health issues in the 21st century compared to what we had 50 and 60 years ago. Let's not worry about the allergies for now. But why is it, do you believe, that mental health has become such a problem area in our society across all generations, not just the young ones?
Yeah, I think it is all generations, but the young ones are ones who have changed the fastest. And I think you might be shocked at the statistics here, Peter. So we measure psychological distress. So it's not a mental illness, but just not coping with stuff. And yeah, okay, it's a self-report, but it's a pretty well-used one around the world. We do it in our national health survey. We do it with large, robust measures. This is good. One thing the Ministry of Health actually does properly. And they first started measuring that in 2005. And in the 16 to 24 age group, it was severe psychological distress was running at 5.6%. Now, by 20, and girls always twice as high as boys, by the way, at everything except for actual suicides, even self-harm in emergency rooms. And that was tracking along pretty constantly until about 2012. And then New Zealand, like every other Western country around that time, it started tilting upwards. And by 2021, it was running at 24.6%. So nearly a 4 to 5-fold increase in the psychological distress. And you go, well, they're just over-reporting it, a bunch of things. And that's probably not the case. These kids are not handling their emotions as well as previous generations. And you go, geez, that's weird. What happened around 2012 or so, and what's pushed that upwards? And I think where the evidence lies is that it's interfered with our brains, but it's done that in an area around this dopamine system, but it's really around social media, gaming, junk food, porn, all of these things bang drugs, all of these things bang this pleasure system up, 10 times more than it was ever supposed to. And the net result of that is that the system down-regulates. And so, this is the classic smoking problem, right? You start with nicotine, it gives you pleasure, but eventually you adapt to it and down-regulate. Now all you're doing is pushing yourself out of pain and back to where someone who doesn't smoke was at baseline. And so something that gave you pleasure now gives you pain. And now the trouble with that is when you've got that pain, you're in a situation where you can't manage or feel your emotions properly. It's called anhedonia. So your mood's low, you feel crap, you have negative thoughts, things like patting the dog or, going for a run or, riding your bike or these sorts of things no longer give you enough pleasure to pull you out of that zone. So you stop doing them. And then you engage in more things like eating more junk food or more gaming or more vaping, more booze to push it up to somewhere it had to be. And so to me, that's the most likely explanation for the not the baseline, because there's other things that get you there. Like, your dad beat you up when you're a little kid or something. That's shit. But that's the most likely thing that changed in that time. And so you've got this sort of bad feeling epidemic, in reality driven by having too much pleasure. And so, it's just we're the adults in this world and we know that physiology now. It's time to act on it. And this is why most of the people who are big in tech, the big tech entrepreneurs in the US, the one thing they don't give to their kids is an electronic device. I know how these things work.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because 2012 is what, 4 years, 4.5 years after the introduction of the first iteration of the iPhone, right? The mm-hmm. smartphone first arrived in New Zealand, I think, 2007, 2008. Early on, it was a luxury item. Inevitably, it became common as mud, and now everybody's got one. But was it around about that time that they started becoming really common and getting into the hands of 11, 12-year-olds and through the teenage years? And more to the point, the tension those things now cause in families. I know myself,
I've got a 14-year-old
grandson, and the stress that devices cause inside that family is staggering.
And you have to ask if they would just be better off without any devices, and the answer is most probably. But it's a hard one to get past the kids and the parents.
Yeah, and it's probably, or hasn't probably been helped by the attitude of most schools until recent moves have been made to ban the blinking things at all schools. But up until now, a lot of schools have had a pretty liberal attitude towards them, haven't they? Saying, oh, they're really good learning tools. Maybe not so much.
Yeah, and interestingly, some new research just came out of Norway last month, and the first of that, because they'd started banning cell phones a bit before us. And it's interesting that they immediately had, at least for girls, an immediate drop in the requirement for psychiatric services for a young woman as a result of that. So that's an interesting thing that they observed there. I would say, though, I've still got two adult boys, but a 14-year-old, and sometimes I text him at school and he immediately answers. I did ask the principal about that.
Yeah. Well, I know the rector of my old high school that I met up with a year or so ago, he said that they made a very simple thing at their school before this National Party policy came in. They just said no cell phones at school between 8:45 and 3:30 or whatever. And he said in the staff room, they looked out the window at lunchtime and blow me down. The boys, it's an all-boys school. The boys were actually talking to each other. And they were doing things like playing tennis, kicking a football around on the tennis courts on a wet winter's afternoon during the lunch break. He said that the difference to their physical activity during the school breaks was just absolutely marked. And the teachers couldn't help but comment on that after as well, that they came back because of their physical activity during the breaks, they came back better prepared for learning. Does that make sense to you?
100%, and that's just simple biology. And I've observed this recently. Boys' schools are absolutely great for this because you'll see what we remember, Peter, which is there'll be a basketball court with sort of four or five concurrent games going in different directions on there with boys of all ages, and then there'll be someone else with a cricket bat and a hockey stick, and then there'll be tennis, and then there'll be rugby on the field even though it's closed, and those things just spontaneously come back, especially to young men under those conditions, and all of the rough and tumble and the exuberance and the riskiness of that play are, and at least in my expertise, essential to human health and something we're missing.
With all due respect to the great study and the research that you do, this doesn't seem like rocket science to work out.
I've said that.
The more you stay off devices, the better person you're going to be, the more well-rounded person you'll be.
I've said that my research is embarrassingly stupid. It's literally science of the bleeding obvious. It's an embarrassment, frankly, but to the extent that it's epidemically gone the other way, I suppose it hopefully has some value. But yeah, I agree. It's science of the I've said that. I do science of the bleeding obvious, and it's an embarrassment. I've said that, Peter.
Are you making any difference, though, with your research outcomes? Do you believe
No, because on my watch, which has been over the last 25 years, we've gone from the most active country in the OECD to the bottom third. So that's my effort. So I feel tremendously disappointed about that, of my inability to actually personally affect that. I mean, to be fair to me, things have gone the other way with technology and society. That's why I'm keen to to, you know, just keep talking about this. It's a thing. You want to solve youth mental health, just talking about their feelings ain't going to cut it. It's a, you know, Mike King's been a hero. Him and JK have changed the way that we've even thought about mental health, but the next step is not what they're suggesting. The next step is not more counsellors. Like, talking about your feelings is not the problem here, so therefore it's not the solution. It's just as simple as that. And so, you know, if someone's out there, if this affects one person, that's a win.
Yeah, but JK himself said in the very early days of his campaigning, he was on television when talking about Sir John Kirwan here. He featured in a television commercial of him diving in from the side of a pool, doing a few lengths to get the heart rate up, to really bust a gut doing exercise. He was effectively suggesting then, and heaven forbid that campaign was probably, what, best part of a decade ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, longer, most likely. I remember that, actually.
Yeah, if you want to feel better, go and get a sweat up. Go and get your heart rate going. But we're not doing it. We're not learning from that.
No. And one of the best ways to get out of this pleasure cycle is to cause a bit of pain. You could actually race down to one of these lakes around you, Peter, and just jump in right now.
Yeah. I've done that. Don't you worry. I've done the cold water dipping around here. Right? It's therapeutic, to say the least.
Yeah. You don't approach it with glee, but you feel great afterwards.
Yeah. But tell me then, if we have a mental health epidemic, for want of a better word, in our high schools, this government policy is for an hour a day of the 3 hours, the reading, writing, and the arithmetic. What are they doing about physical education? And
another compulsory hour for that. There's good use of time.
Yeah. Is there a physical education curriculum that actually is physical? Because it seems to me that PE these days is a computer subject, a research subject, anatomy and some health issues. It's writing stuff down as opposed to getting sweaty.
Yeah, I think it depends on the school. Like, I did this for a job for 2 years. I was the chief health advisor to the Ministry of Education. Their actual PE curriculum's world class. It's just, again, been taken over by the progressive left, you know, and you want to see the sort of research that goes on in that area. My God. But that's another whole story. You know, boys only schools, particularly like my boys' school, Rosmini College, I think, you know, PE is compulsory, and it's physical PE, and that's throughout the whole school, and away you go. And so, you know, good on them. That's great. But actually, you know, we've researched this for years. It's not enough. It's also, you know, ranging around your neighborhood. It's on the weekend. That's where the big hits count. And there are a third of New Zealand kids that are really active, and they accumulate that with, you know, some sports. That's good, but they also just have the ability to get to and from school on their own 2 feet or two wheels. They go out and they cut, you know, and regional New Zealand is great for this. You know, Cromwell, Tairua, where we live, Whangamata, these types of communities. The idea of the free range kids still exists in those places, and they do better for it.
Yeah, I go past Cromwell College when I'm in town, and I actually see bikes there up against bikes in racks, and I'm thinking, boy, you don't see that at too many schools around the country anymore.
Well, certainly not in a Christchurch, Auckland or Wellington type situation.
Well, I think it's appalling that the staff actually provide car parks for students. Really? But more importantly, Grant, with mental health issues, how many drugs are being prescribed by GPs? Are they taking the easy way out in this mental health issue?
Yeah, that's something I feel quite strongly about. So, you know, particularly antidepressants, so the group called SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, are pretty widely prescribed, and even to children of quite young ages. Just to be clear, what the actual guidelines are from the Australasian College of Psychiatrists is that really they're pretty much off-label for young people, and because there's often serious harms. And for everyone else, we should exhaust lifestyle and talk therapies before we go to those medicines, especially for mild to moderate problems. And you show me, unfortunately, that's been not happening. And in general practice, you know, I think they're widely overprescribed as the first line of treatment. And the thing is, they have some positive effect for some people, but you can expect that to be temporary because they you know, if they do have an effect, I think it's one of numbing. So they numb bad feelings, but they also numb good feelings. So that's not that awesome. They also cause genital numbing in 100% of people. So that's, I don't know if people would take them if they knew that, and sexual dysfunction and these types of things. So there's harms, there's some benefits. The work by my colleague in the University of Canterbury, Professor Julia Ruckledge, she gets better effects by putting people on high-dose multivitamins and other foods. So, you know, there you go.
Wow. What about a topic that this government doesn't seem to want to engage in, namely puberty blockers? We've had the Cass report. Hilary Cass and her research in the UK has said puberty blockers are a bad idea, yet New Zealand, up until recently, maybe it's still the case, I don't know, was the highest prescriber per capita of puberty blockers in the world. Is that still going on? How much does that impact on mental health issues?
Yeah, well, I think that probably some of those are preceded by mental health issues, but that's another story. I mean, this isn't my area of expertise, but I do want to say in this that what I encourage people to do is in any medical intervention, there's always a balance of harm and there's a balance of good. And so then it's not up to the physician to decide that. It's up to the people who are providing consent of care. If that's the parents, if they're under a certain age, that's them. And then it's when you're adults, you can decide that yourself as well. But when you're deciding that, think very carefully about the plausible harms and the plausible benefits, because you know, these are real things that'll affect real people. Now, there are people that'll, you know, have a different gender identity, and you know, that's fine. And some of those people will do that, but I encourage them to do that when they're adults, when they can conceive fully of, you know, irreversible procedures. Harms versus benefits are, and you know, the first tenet of medicine is the Hippocratic Oath, to first do no harm. Now, there's a practical reality to that in medicine, because anytime you do a surgery or any medical procedure or take a medicine, there's always a chance of a harm. And so in practical reality, first do no harm means, you know, be damn sure that you're pretty clear that the benefits are going to outweigh the harms, and the person consenting understands that. So, you know, we would never have got into the mess we were in COVID if we'd operated with that principle.
Yeah, sure. We'll talk about your attitude to COVID and your advice to COVID and the discussions you've had about the COVID response very shortly, but just staying with the puberty blocker issue, do you actually think it's irresponsible on the part of GPs to be prescribing these to those who are not through puberty? We're talking, you know, 14, 15-year-olds?
Well, you want to be convinced that them and their parents who were providing the duty of care fully understood what the I mean, personally, I wouldn't do it if it was me as a treating physician, but since that isn't me, I guess people will have to, and it's not against the law in New Zealand at the moment, then people will make that decision on the balance of harms and benefits, but they just need to really, really, really think about that. And we don't do that well in medicine. A good example is something completely different, back surgery. There's a back surgeries, you know, some of these back surgeries, you know, you do 20 operations, two people get better from baseline, four people get worse, and the remaining 16 need to get better or worse. Like, those are terrible odds.
Really, is that the outcome according to orthopedic surgeons?
Well, that's for a specific type, which is a fusing with a ceramic glue, two spinal things together. That's about what we call number treated to harm. But you'd be surprised when you start to look at the numbers across all spinal surgeries around the chance of benefit and chance of harm. And mostly what predicts benefit is that you're going to be active and do some rehab, which if you've done it anyway, you know, they do these sham surgeries. They'll give people, we've operated on your back, you know, they'll give them sutures, or anesthetize them, and they do just as well as not getting it, as getting it in the first place. So, you know, go figure.
Listening to you say that, Grant, reminds me of a podcast I heard last week featuring a young woman in California called Casey Means, who...
Yeah.
And whether or not you've heard of her, she was a surgeon. She was on her way to being a highly qualified surgeon at Stanford Medical School. She'd been top graduate in her undergraduate class, president of the class, and at the age of 30 gave it all away because she thought, this is just stupid. America is becoming a more unhealthy nation by the year, and despite all the great medical interventions, the country's getting sicker. What's wrong here? So she has changed tack completely and is now addressing American health with the aid of her brother, who ironically was a lobbyist in the food and pharmaceutical industry. They're trying to get people to basically eat healthy, exercise, and stay away from the doctor, away from what they call the medico-industrial complex. I guess you would have a certain sympathy with that story, even though I've just outlined it very briefly.
Yeah, and there's another YouTuber, a guy called Dr. Believe it or not, Dr. Gooby, who walks with his dog called Doobie, who was a neurosurgeon doing spinal surgeries and has recently quit for exactly the reasons we're outlining. Is now trying to do those messages. But actually, what we might be more buoyed by in recent news was JFK Jr.'s announcement.
RFK Jr., sorry.
My apologies. Because he really prefaced that, you know, I think he's gone into the Trump den with his eyes wide open, but he's looking to get an impact on health. And his main state around that is to hold big pharma, big food to account, and the CDC and the FDA and the US Department of Agriculture, all of the corrupt players in the US medical complex that is, you know, has not only not sorted the problem of chronic disease, especially for children, but caused it. And so, you know, my hat's off to someone to finally stand up and do that with some political power in the US. That's no small feat.
Yeah, well, he was polling quite high at one stage. Whether or not he has maintained that level, I have my doubts. But even if he's got 5-6%, which in the end might sway the election Trump's way, if he then gets a cabinet post, that will be really draining the swamp. He'll then have, you know, the big struggle to convince the bureaucrats, of course, and the bureaucrats run countries these days and run councils. I think we're finding that out by the day, sadly. But if he can make an impact with those bureaucrats and find some like-minded thinking in the American public service, then who knows which direction he might be able to take the country.
Yeah, you're right, Peter, because if no one tries, you're not certainly going to make any progress, but, you know, at least someone's having a go. And he might be cut down before this election with, you know, lobbying and who knows what. I've already seen some of that online, but, you know, you never know.
Yeah, well, he'll get the anti-vax label pretty quickly, I'm sure, from the liberal left. That's possibly a label that you've had as well, Grant, because you've made some comments about the COVID response. In fact, I'm intrigued that you were recently a speaker at the GPCME, the General Practitioners Conference and Medical Exhibition. And heaven forbid, you're not a medically trained doctor, you're a professor of public health, but not a medically trained doctor, yet you were speaking at a GP's conference and they allowed you on a panel. What happened, Grant?
Well, I've got to congratulate the convener of this is Dr. Peter Chapman, who runs these events in New Zealand. And I think he's had his eyes more wide open than most, and I think he's waited till the time was right to start what he thought was a reasonable open discussion. So they have two events a year. One's in Rotorua, which was a couple of months ago, and then one just last weekend in Christchurch. And he organised it both things to have, you know, people from both sides of that COVID response to have something to say. So it's even great last weekend. Simon Thornley even got there, which was good. But I really concentrated on the mandates and the law. So far as around the Bill of Rights, the Education Act, as far as academic freedom was concerned, the coercion, the evidence for harm and benefit in particularly young people. I just decided I would stick with those because I had spoken and written quite a lot about those at the time. Felt like I was the only one. But yeah, you're right. It was interesting. Even at that conference, they started to use the words, two words which really get up my nose because they're used in a way to gaslight anyone who disagrees with them. So the two words are anti-vaxxer and conspiracy theorists. And actually in the Christchurch one was interesting because I made that point in the panel discussion afterwards when they started throwing those around about how not only objectionable they were, but the way that they were weaponized and being used in ways that were radically unfair. And actually, there was a whole bunch of doctors in the conference who burst into applause just at that. So I suppose that's encouraging in some way. I mean, I went pretty hard, especially in the Christchurch one. In the panel discussion, even the, you know, we were the world champions of COVID guys from Otago acknowledged that the mandates were wrong and we should never have done them. And this, so my Michael response Baker to that, well, Baker wasn't invited, but my response to them is like, oh, that's great. Where were you at the time if they were wrong? Because I never heard from any of you. Again, applause from the GP crowd. So, you know, let's not think of the whole medical profession as being asleep at the wheel. You know, I think there's a lot more waking up to what went on, especially with the mandating side of things, young people, harm versus benefit, you know, all of the perversity that we know about of jobs, Peter, businesses, funerals, weddings, sick children. You know,
at the Rotorua conference, is it Dr. Child, Simon Child? Stephen Child, rather.
Yeah.
A board member of the Medical Council, which is absolutely the medical establishment, and just hated anybody, any doctor, any layperson who fought back against mandates and about the efficacy and the safety of vaccines. What's a guy like him thinking these days, 4 years on, knowing full well that that vaccine just did not work?
I think they're sleepishly acknowledging, especially around the mandating and, you know, the fact that that's even proven to be illegal and was illegal at the time, and the government overreached, the Health Act, which was breached by Cabinet because, we know now that Bloomfield didn't support the mandates, and that was overturned by Cabinet. That was illegal because the Director General Health had the authority on that, not Cabinet. And so I think they acknowledge it. And I put a slide up of the Medical Council in that talk saying, you guys have a code of ethics around informed consent. Here it is. And you didn't stick to this. And at the very least, we should all walk away and think about how we manage that process and what we would do different next time. So I don't know if that will make any difference, but at least there's more of a discussion around this. And I think the win here, you know, you're never going to get anywhere with the excess deaths and all that stuff with these guys. Like I'll leave that to Simon Thornley and they can beat it out, but good luck with that. But I feel the win is the mandates and the perversity of how we all behaved.
Yeah, so these medical professionals, the medical council, the establishment, the Nikki Turners from IMAC, the Immunisation Advisory Council, they see numbers hitting them in the face. Do they not believe what's written in front of them?
No, they don't. And, you know, Peter, I don't have sympathy for them, but I understand that in some ways. You know, it goes back to the academic freedom stuff we started with. You know, in the 1950s, one of the most famous psychologists was a guy called Leon Festinger, and he introduced the idea of cognitive dissonance. And then his famous book was, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Us. It's a fundamental human characteristic to think that way, and it's one that's plagued science the whole time we've done science. And that's why the academic freedom stuff is so important, because you need someone else to come at it who's not you. They're not going to change their mind. At the very least, I could go, oh, yeah, that was overreach. I think we have to learn to live with that, unfortunately. But my view next time is this won't happen again, in the sense that
Will rise up, won't it? The population will marching in the streets.
Exactly my point. I think there would be 30% of the population is going, no, I've seen this before. I just can't imagine this being a thing again. I hope I'm right.
So do I. Yeah. what about this phase two inquiry, the so-called phase two inquiry? Do you have any faith in that heads might roll? Like Ardern and Bloomfield might be questioned, cross-examined on the stand at this inquiry, and
publicly
really put on them?
Well, I hope so, but I haven't heard even an inside word about, you know, who would lead that. And so I just don't know who will or could lead that now that would do that, and that, you know, all of the sides on this are going to find acceptable. I don't know who that and how that would happen. I mean, let's face it, the first one was not even an inquiry. The second one was basically...
That was crazy, wasn't it?
Yeah. The next one with Blakely was, you know, basically a farce, and, you know, not public, not released, you know, conflicts of interest from people doing it that were untenable. And so, you know, I mean, if it's going to start, it needs to start. Otherwise, it'll be a bit like, you know, looking at Christchurch Cathedral now going, oh, that happened 15 years ago, you know?
Mm, yeah, and we're not going to pay for it, and we're going to have a great tourist attraction of a half-built wrecked cathedral.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mess so, I was down there.
So do we have to have an overseas person to lead this second inquiry? Do we at least have to have the semblance of independence from perhaps a retired judge from Canada or Australia or Britain or somewhere?
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah.
What about medical experts?
I don't know about that, Peter, because I think it's the legal process and a public fairness around that's probably more important. That's why I do support like a retired judge from another country. And the medical opinions will come. The trouble is, if you're already in medicine, then you've got festering as dissonance, no matter what, because you would have had an opinion on COVID medically and whatever that was. Yeah, I can't do it. Simon Thorney can't do it, and Tony Blakely and the rest of Michael the Blakely Dunedin crowd can't do it either.
Yeah,
you know.
So, what's the School of Public Health at AUT saying about it? Are you speaking as one on this matter, or are you having robust discussions in your faculty meetings about the COVID response even now?
I don't think anyone's talking about the COVID response or wants to talk about it in any way, shape, or form at all.
Is it just too hard to
any part of the university? No, it's not a topic that anyone's prepared to raise. And I think that's disappointing because I think as I made a point to the medical professionals in Christchurch last week. Oh, well, you know, there was a lot happening at the time. I was like, what? You mean to say that the biggest thing that's ever happened in the history of New Zealand medicine, you know, mandating these vaccines and what happened as a consequence, was just a lot happening at the time, so we didn't have time to think about it. You know, like, goodness sake, how that's the thing is utterly beyond me. So, you know, even say, Peter, we had something that was, you know, completely safe and effective, we should have still been skeptical about it and had a discussion. That's just, you know, good practice.
Mm. What do you think about trust in the medical profession these days? Has it dropped and is it retrievable?
Well, so that was a question. A doctor in the audience at Christchurch said, look, you know, I just can't understand this. No one trusts me anymore. Not even my son will listen to me. He says, I've got no idea. And he says, I just can't understand it at all. Can you guys explain what's happened? Because I just don't get it. You know, so that's at one level what you're dealing with, right? Of course, Simon Thornley and I just are laughing. Well, he's actually trying to keep a straight face because, you know, he gets in more trouble than I do. he did make a good point to me, Peter. He said at dinner that night, he said, Grant, the best thing that ever happened to you is that you never got a medical degree.
Yeah, so therefore you don't know what you're talking about.
No, that I can talk about it without fear of recriminations from the medical council.
That's right, you can't lose your registration to practice.
No, they wanted to kick me off, I'm not even on it.
Yeah.
So,
you know what, to me, is still the most disappointing thing? We hear stories day after day about the state of the health system, about Code Black at Whangarei Hospital and about this ED being overrun and about not being able to get a registration or to be enrolled at a GP practice in various places around the country. All these terrible stories about underfunding of the health service. Not once, Grant, have I heard any sort of public health campaign about stop eating crap food, go and take a run around the block, Go and get 8 hours sleep every night. Stay off the booze. Lead a healthy life. I mean, when is that campaign going to start, Grant?
Well, we used to actually be, believe it or not, back in the days of the Hillary Commission, then learning into what was it called then, Spark, Sport and Recreation.
SPARC, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
We used to actually do quite well on this. We had one of the best campaigns in the world, and that was the time, you know, people go, these don't work. But, you know, frankly, we had the most active country in the world and the most active children in the world. Even going back a generation before that, I don't remember if you remember the Come Alive Kiwi campaign, Peter.
I do, yeah.
I even had a poster of all the different Kiwis doing all the different sports. I mean, some of it was pub darts, admittedly, but still, these were, you know, Kiwi birds being active. It was great, and that's all disappeared.
Yeah. What about at school? Are they encouraging kids to play sport? Now, I've always had a bit of an issue with sports compulsion because I know that there are some kids who are just out and out bookworms and nerds and hopelessly uncoordinated, so it will be embarrassing at sports. But, you know, it's good for you, isn't it, to be involved in some sort of, you know, minor physical activity on a regular basis, isn't it?
Well, I think the minimum guidelines for kids are an hour of moderate to vigorous activity a day. And they actually go on to say up to several hours. So, you know, just to put that in context, so you go and measure what your average New Zealand kid does these days, and it's, you know, nowhere near that, of course. But not all Kiwi kids are like that. They're just, you know, populated. There's a third of our kids are awesome kids with awesome parents doing awesome lives. You know, we'd just rather it was more than that.
But in the public health sphere that you work in, do you see any enthusiasm for a public health campaign about what I was just talking about, the exercise, the food, the sleep, the healthy lifestyle, as opposed to constantly going to the doctor, going to ED, getting on the drugs?
Yeah, well, welcome to my life. I mean, that would make my life basically, Peter, if we could do that. So if anyone at RCA has got any connections, bring that on. But, you know, the reality is that we spend 99.8% of our health budget on, you know, on sick people. And, you know, fair enough, you break your leg, you're out mountain biking, that would be good if they fixed it. But if we invested 10% of the $2.8 billion on healthy diet, good night's sleep, getting outside in nature, you know, being physically active, then we'd be a completely different country. It's clearly the only solution because it's the cause of the problem in the first place. You want to solve the cause, you've got to, you know, what other options have you got? You've got to sort the cause out.
Do you believe that the pharmaceutical industry has way too much influence in New Zealand health policy?
Well, of course it does. And the fact that Pharmac won't release on OIA what the pharmaceutical industry puts into it cash-wise, because, believe it or not, this could harm public's perceptions around Pharmac, is an absolute disgrace. You know, that alone speaks volumes about the influence.
Well, I made an official information request to MedSafe sometime last year to find out how much of the MedSafe budget was paid for by pharmaceutical companies, bearing in mind that I found out that in Australia, the equivalent over there, the TGA, the Therapeutic Goods Authority, 96% of their budget is paid for by pharmaceutical companies through their fees for approval.
So that's you that did that.
Sorry?
That was you that did that. Okay.
Yeah, I never did anything with it at the time because I was only working part-time. But basically it came back and said that the vast majority of the MedSafe budget is paid for by pharmaceutical companies through their approval applications. Mm. So what do we make of that? There's no independent testing, I guess is what we can say, no independent testing of drugs about whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, and whether, in fact, they make any difference.
Yeah, well, this has been Julia Ruckledge's problem when she showed these, you know, really positive effects of relatively cheap high doses of multivitamins and minerals on, you know, a range of mental health disorders. But to get them approved, now they're classified as a pharmaceutical because they have these clinical effects, and, you know, she would have to somehow pay for them to get through MedSafe. You know, it's just an impossible process. So, you know, you're just stuck in a situation where you can't get any approval.
Well, we had that piece of legislation passed by the last government, didn't we, which I think is either being repealed or is going to be repealed, namely that Therapeutic Goods Act, which was
going I think that's gone
as medicines, and it was going to make life very difficult for people like, for instance, John Appleton, the man who distributes lipospheric vitamin C, which is a product that I happen to swear by.
Yeah.
And it certainly kept me fit and healthy for most of the last 5 or 6 years since I've been doing it. Yet John was telling me the terrible problems that he potentially faced if that law had gone through and stayed in place. It just seems vitamin C, for God's sake.
Just another example of the progressive left running way too far, causing more harm than good. But I think luckily the current coalition has just kicked that into touch. It's already gone.
Yeah. Grant, can we just finish by talking a little bit about the Olympics? I know you're a great sports fan. The Olympics were obviously fantastically successful as far as New Zealand was concerned, but there were one or two, shall we say, intriguing aspects of it, particularly the transgender thing, the XY chromosome boxers who won their gold medals. How can the IOC be so stupid as to allow that to happen, do you believe?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. I remember reading two books, one in the early 90s called The Lords of the Rings, and then by a British journalist, and then he wrote another one in the late
90s. Andrew Jennings,
The New Lords of the Rings.
Yeah.
And they're still good reads, you know, about the corruption and greed and the brokenness of that system. You know, that's nearly, is that 30 years ago now, Peter?
Precisely, yeah.
And I don't think you'd say things have – I'd say things have changed, but they haven't got better. They've got worse over that time. So it's simply a big business. You know, I reckon there's four things I want to talk about with the Olympics here. The first is the whole opening ceremony. Well, that was pretty random. Who knows what's going on there? But do what they want. Who cares? Yeah. I'm not going to watch that again. Then a highlight then of, you know, actual pure sports, given it's a sport both you and I have engaged in our life, was Hayden Wild's triathlon. I just thought that was, even though he got overtaken at the end, like, you got to give it to someone who just is never going to die wondering and, you know, is an astonishing athlete. So that was cool. Then the transgender, well, they're not even transgender. So they were born with chromosomes that are male and have got testosterone.
They were boxing's Caster Semenya, really, weren't they?
Yeah. So there's sometimes you're born with stuff that doesn't allow you to participate in sports at the highest level. Now, some of those things are obviously, you go on the blind shooting. Well, good luck with that one. You know, it's a real disadvantage. And so, you know, bummer. And sometimes it goes the other way. And I think that one crossed the line. And, you know, you talk about safety. Well, that was safety. So that should never have clearly happened. And I think any clear thinking person would agree with that. So it wasn't really a transgender issue. It was more actually, yeah, most sports have come around to the transgender issue, but this was another sort of thing. I'll tell you the thing I thought was the most disgraceful, actually, because it sums up pretty much everything we've been talking about from academia, because the woman, Ray Gunn, the breakdancer, was an Australian academic, and from that progressive left, sort of,
well, to do a PhD on breakdancing, I mean, dear me.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, you could presumably do some sort of PhD or something about breakdancing, but it's the sort of liberal feminist lens. You know, when you actually look at what the research is, there are some humans, but no logical human is going to look at that and go, that's cool stuff. And then how it was set up and then what she did, I still think no one could – well, on the negative side, no one could be that useless on purpose. Like, you and I could probably do better with some –
You know, the All Black coach could have.
Well, yeah, he's pretty good. on the positive note, to finish that one with, you know, one good thing about that, we all watched that and thought, I could have a go at this, you know. and it was Australians and we could openly mock them. And so we should – as Kiwis, celebrate that these are all good things. So, you know, on balance, the Olympics was interesting, had its ups and downs. There was a new sport that I actually liked, Peter, and it was the speed climbing. And I know people were critical, but I just thought if you wanted to see an athlete, particularly the woman in that were like a real-life Spider-Man, then They were extraordinary.
They
That's
were.
My opinion anyway.
Yeah, no, precisely. And I made the comment when the games were on that we have at one end of the spectrum the road cycling race where the athletes are on their bikes and on their bottoms and slogging their guts out for, what, 4.5, upwards of 5 hours. Mm-hmm. Yet you've got speed climbing where the best of them are doing a course in about 4 seconds.
You know, that's true. And you know, we support the suffering end of it. We like that part of it. That's how we're wired. But, you know, anyway.
Yeah, the Olympics are really at a really interesting stage, I think, in that the number of cities who can host them is obviously getting smaller and smaller. The Commonwealth Games, to me, are dead and buried. Heaven knows what Glasgow is going to be like in a couple of years when they try to put forward this reimagined version of the Commonwealth Games. The Olympics are really battling. Brisbane is still fighting about where its stadium is going to be. It's going to bankrupt the city. There's no doubt about that. So you have to, at some stage, surely put a limit on the size of the Olympic Games, the number of athletes, the number of sports. And because of digital television these days, the games are probably not as well watched as they were, or conversely, they're probably more watched than ever because of 7 or 8 channels, but they're a lot harder to watch now, aren't they? In days gone by on TV1 and my time, you just watched the one channel. Now you've got 6, 7 channels going. You don't know what's on.
When I saw the kid skateboarding pull out a cell phone as he's about to kick off on his Olympic final, take a selfie of himself, and then halfway through one of his tricks, his cell phone falls out of his pocket. it was pretty clear to me that that wasn't a sport that should really be there.
No, but good thing about it, Grant, those skateboarders are 14, 15 years of age.
Yeah.
I wonder, and I hope, that they don't have mental health issues because they're on those skateboards hours and hours every day. They're getting a sweat up, getting their heart rate up. They're getting fit. They're being athletic. And you cannot, in your profession, and in my observation of sport, you cannot deny the good that skateboarding is doing for those kids.
No, and so just to back myself out of my corner here, my local community in Tyra recently opened a skate park after much high court injunctions over the years, and we did donate to that. So, you know, there we go.
Yeah, very good. Grant Schofield, Professor of Public Health at AUT University, thank you so much for joining us here on RCR. An absolute pleasure. We've covered a wide gamut of topics, but it's been interesting, and I appreciate your honesty. I hope that it has not been a career-threatening or indeed a career-ending interview, but good luck anyway. If it is, well, I'm sure you'll find something else to do, which is just as worthwhile in the community. So nice talking to you.
It'll be a good fireside story that Peter Williams was the end of it all.
Good on you, Grant. Nice talking to you.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.